that simple, I think. You know, will it make you as a family more financially secure if we cut ourselves off? You know, what will that uncertainty feel like in the workplace if we voted to leave? Europe aren't going to let us go lightly. I would think we'll get a lot of resentment coming towards Britain if we vote to leave. You know, I think we're going to find ourselves out in the cold very quickly. And what will it feel like? How secure, how confident will you be about your job on Friday, June the 24th, if we voted to leave? And I think we've got to get that into people's minds. That is a kitchen table case. You know, let's not necessarily throw all the stats at people. Just ask them a simple question, is the way I would put it, if you really want to get over to people. Of course, I think as Liv said at the beginning, there are other things that we can argue about the effect on prices, the workers' argument around the social protections that we enjoy as being part of a European Union. But let's also go straight to that issue as well about immigration. And let's ask people here to think about this issue in its widest sense. Let's remind people that in the 1980s and the 1990s, thousands of people made redundant here went to work elsewhere in the European Union using the freedoms that are available to British workers to find work elsewhere. My dad was one of them, made redundant in British Telecom, Portland Street, just around the corner from here, that's where he worked, made redundant in the late 1980s, early 1990s, and went to work in Germany. People have forgotten about that. They think of immigration as a one-way street. It's not. It's a two-way street. And there are many thousands of people from the Northwest working abroad across the European Union today. And we need to remind people about that. But in some ways, I'm going to actually take issue with the kind of premise of today, which is a bit of a dangerous thing to do. Liv's getting worried now. But it's okay. Come in, you're very welcome. I'm going to take issue because I think if we're only thinking about the economic case, I think we might miss something in this whole referendum campaign. And it may even be encouraging us to go the wrong way. And that might even reveal the heart of the problem. Because if those of us campaigning to stay in the European Union are purely trying to make the economic case, the rational case, the statistics, I worry that we won't be going to the heart of where this argument will be for most people. I don't think it'll be the ground on which this referendum is won or lost. I think the ground on which this referendum is being fought already in people's minds is British identity, what it means to be British, and the fear that there is some sort of erosion of British identity as from being part of Europe. And my worry is, actually, if we're only making the economic case and the rational case, we may cede that ground to the Leave campaign completely, and they will be the ones kind of making the emotional appeal to people and claiming to be those only speaking for Britain and its interests. They're the ones, the guardians of what it is to be British, and they're not. Nothing could be further from the truth. You know, but there is a danger here, isn't there, if you just think about it. If this referendum campaign kind of, by the end, becomes a kind of a match between two teams, one dressed in red, white and blue, and the other team in blue and yellow, where one team is playing a game that is very much about the emotional appeal and the other is making a kind of rational case, you can see how in those circumstances it could be quite hard to win a match that is being played on that basis. You know, it's not going to work, I don't think, just to appeal to the head and let the other side appeal to the heart. The in campaign has got to appeal to people's hearts as well as their heads. And that is crucial, I think, if we're going to get in this fight in the right way. And that's my big argument today. And in many ways, it feels a counterintuitive argument to put to a Fabian Society audience. But it is this. My argument is that we've got to make the patriotic case to stay in the European Union, and not just the economic case. We have to make that, of course we do, but we have to make the patriotic case as well, and not be afraid of doing it. We've got to be ready to fight them on the beaches of what it means to be British, and not let them have that ground as though they're the only people who occupy that territory. My argument would be to vote to stay in the European Union is the vote that is true to Britain's past, its history, its tradition of playing that more expansive role on the world stage. That is who we are and what we have been in history. That is how the world has looked to us in the past, to play that role, to stand for the right values, and to be ready to ensure those values are upheld, and to put ourselves out to secure those things. I would say a vote to leave is a vote to break with that past, is a rejection of actually Britain's past. A vote to leave is a vote to make Britain a changed nation, diminished, inward-looking, not outward-looking. That's what it is, in my view, to vote to leave the European Union. It's to make Britain a very different country to what we were in the 20th century. And I believe in the end, if you really think about it, if you want to get to the kitchen table and to what will actually motivate people and move people in this debate, I think you have to get into that more emotional, patriotic case, as well as making the economic argument. So in the time I've got there, I just want to kind of flesh out what I think that case looks, sounds and feels like. And I want to start developing a language that we might talk about that might feel comfortable for us to make. The first thing I would say in terms of making that more patriotic case is that if we vote to leave, it will certainly diminish Britain in the eyes of the world. The world will look at us and think, well, they've changed. That's how the rest of the world will see us. They will think of Britain differently. And I would say more negatively than they did before. As though Britain has decided to pull back and to pull ourselves away from those international organisations that we shaped in the last century. The second argument I would make would be to vote to leave would be, in effect, to give up our traditional role of being the bridgehead between the United States of America and Europe, explaining the US to Europe and Europe back to the US. That is the role in history that this country has played. If we were to vote to leave, we would, in effect, be losing that influence, and we'd be giving up on that crucial role that we play that helps hold the world together, helps hold Europe and America together, and by doing that, helps uphold the values of democracy and equality around the world. If we break with that at a moment where the US is flirting with more right-wing politics, that, I would say, would be a very dangerous thing for us to do. The third argument I would make, and it touches on my policy brief, which possibly is the kitchen table argument that will cut most ice, I would guess, is if we vote to leave, we'll be less able to defend ourselves as a country and defend our interests in a very dangerous world. And of course I'm talking about terrorism there, but I'm also talking about state aggression as well. If, thinking about that point I just made about the bridgehead, if we vote to leave on Friday the 24th of June, if that's where we are, you can be sure of this, there'll be weeping in the White House, but whooping in the Kremlin, basically. That is what the effect of our vote will have on world politics. And you've got to get that through to people. If the United States of America will be worried about our vote, but The Kremlin would be delighted. That tells you, I think, a lot of what you need to know about whether or not this is a good or bad thing to stay in the EU. We need to get over to people that Russia today are making regular incursions into UK airspace. It happened, I think, 10 days ago. They are taunting us. They are seeking confrontation with Britain. Who knows where that will go? Are we safer in the face of that on our own, outside of the EU? Or are we safer staying part of the world's largest economic power, largest market? Undoubtedly, we're safer as a country staying part of that economic and political union in responding in the right way to the changes in world politics that we are seeing. But it is also about making our own streets safer in terms of the threat from international terrorism. Now, I was a Home Office Minister on the day when London was bombed on 7/7, and then the failed bombing on the 21st of June, 2 weeks later. And I can tell you it was quite a frightening moment to be sitting where I was at that time. And I will never forget, in the immediate aftermath of that, how one of the bombers, failed bombers from the 21st of June, escaped through the Eurostar terminal then at Waterloo, and was immediately subject to an Interpol alert, and within a matter of days was brought back to the UK to face justice. Keir Starmer, the former Director of Public Prosecutions, who's part of my shadow home team, said that if we hadn't have been part of the European arrest warrant at that point, we'd be lucky if he was touching down now to face justice in the British courts. But actually, because of our cooperation, we were able to respond straight away. And that cooperation is utterly crucial when it comes to the international terror threat that we face. It is, by definition, operating beyond individual country boundaries. To say that we can better fight terrorism by being alone on our own, well, that, I'm afraid, doesn't stand to reason. Look at Theresa May's own journey. When she became Home Secretary, she made a great flourish of opting out of all kinds of measures of EU cooperation on justice and home affairs, sounding a very deliberate Eurosceptic note. She signalled scepticism about the European arrest warrant. She said we would no longer be part of the Schengen information system, which shares alerts around Europe. She took us out of the protocol around sharing fingerprinting and DNA data across Europe. And do you know what she's done? Quietly, over the last 6 years, she's slowly opted back into all of it. Because the reality of doing her job has shown her how we cannot fight crime, organised crime, and the terror threat by trying to do it on our own. She has been forced on her own journey to face up to the fact that European cooperation makes us stronger and makes us safer as a country. I want to point to her journey to show that that is a sure sign of how the European argument points to us being stronger and safer at being part of Europe. The fourth point I'd make on this patriotic case is that I think we may be looking at the breakup of our own country if we leave Europe. If England, a majority, carries a vote to leave the European Union, I think it's almost certain that within the decade there will be a second Scottish referendum. And that time, I think it's been much more likely that Scotland would then vote to leave the UK. And that too needs to be considered. It would be a path towards fragmentation. If you go down this path and you start to pull out of Europe, all of the international cooperation, I believe, starts to break down. And it's a future of greater fragmentation, but also greater nationalism of all of its forms. And the last point really would be that one. To do this would be to forget the lessons of the 20th century. And actually would be to deny what this country did in the last century to bring peace in Europe. If our grandfathers and our great-grandfathers were here, what would they be telling us? Those people who fought for peace in Europe, what would they be telling us to do right now? And I think we need to invoke that. We have to remind people of that. Britain gave an enormous sacrifice in the first half of the 20th century to make the second half of the 20th century much more peaceful, to end conflict in Europe. That was what they achieved in that last century. And how can it follow that we now deny all of that and we go back to a path of breaking away, creating divide, creating division, creating the conditions potentially for more conflict in Europe? Because that's what will come. You know, my wife is Dutch. I was in Brussels last week with the family, not on an official visit, and I was talking to in-laws while we were over there, and they were all saying people in Europe are beginning to say, why don't they just go? If they don't want to be part of it, just okay, it doesn't matter, but you know, don't make us beg to keep you anymore, Britain. You know, if you want to go, go. And I think patience is slightly wearing a little thin over in Europe. And we've got to remember that. We've got to remember that it was this country which won the peace in Europe and created the institutions that then have secured that peace. And in the second half of the 20th century, and in the first part of this, has brought the most unbroken period of peace in Europe that we have ever seen. And you know, I was with my kids in Ypres last week, and we were wandering around the battlefield. And this argument really started to come through to me that we can't just leave this ground, can we, to the Leave campaigners to suggest that they are the guardians of what it means to be British. They are the people; only they can stand up for British identity and what that meant. I would argue exactly the opposite. They're standing for a version of Britishness that we've not had in our recent past. Britishness has meant outward looking, not inward looking. It has meant playing our part in the world, on that world stage. And I'm not prepared just to see that ripped up and Britain to become a different country overnight, which is what I believe would happen. And I personally believe this is where we've got to take this argument. Please, by all means, don't misunderstand me. Make that economic case for staying in Europe. Make it strongly. But let's not make that alone. Because if we make that alone, it looks like we're just appealing to the head and not the heart. And we're just saying, you know, it means this in terms of prices or brings this many jobs. The danger, of course, is that those statistics just bounce off people and they don't actually, you know, take them on board. This argument is now being formed something deeper, and it's something about Britain and what it will mean to be British in this century. And I am certain that staying in the European Union is true to what we were in the last century, what we fought for, what people gave their lives for. And we've got to make that argument now, not in a few weeks or a few months. Make it now. Get out there and fight with passion in this campaign. Not fight with statistics or spreadsheets, fight with some passion in terms of what this country did, what we achieved in the last century, and what we're now prepared to go out and say, this is what we want for the 21st century. That's the country that I want my kids to grow up in, a Britain that's outward looking, that's playing its part in Europe, playing its part in the world. I don't want to allow the nascent nationalism that we see around Europe to be given a boost by Britain's exit. But those are the issues that we have at stake here. There's so much to fight for, but it's time to fight with our heads and our hearts. And as I say, make an appeal to people that goes to that concern they have about Britain and its place in the world in the 21st century. Thank you very much indeed for listening.
Fight with passion, not statistics. Thanks very much, Andy. That was a fantastic speech to set us off this afternoon. I'm now going to ask the other two panellists just to say a few brief words before we have a bit of a discussion with an open mic. And Mary, I'd like to ask you to come up first just for 5 minutes. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much indeed. Well, I've got a lot to say on this, so I'm going to speak fast. First of all, I want you to look very carefully at what I'm wearing. I'm wearing the Brandenburg Gate today. And this was made by Mr. Berlin jeweller. Brandenburg Gate was where the wall that divided Europe in 1989, where people gathered to say that they weren't going to be divided anymore, they weren't going to labour under the yoke of communism anymore, and that they wanted the freedom to do the stuff that we in the West were doing. So for me, this is my little symbol of hope and resistance in Europe. And I want you all to think about what you're wearing today, because the one thing we all have in common is that we're all wearing clothes. Thank God. East wind blowing in from Siberia. And this has been a very interesting EU referendum debate. Some funny bedfellows. Well, it's a metaphor, by the way. Nigel Farage, George Galloway, Michael Gove and Boris Johnson all in bed together. Voting to leave, and on Sunday night, yeah, I know. No, George in his red cap, no. And on Sunday night, I found myself arguing alongside Edwina Curry on Five Live. So these are strange days indeed in the political world. But this week we had London Fashion Week, and it ended on Tuesday. And I bet the EU referendum couldn't have been further from the minds of the people that turned up there. It's always the debate about, are the models too thin? Is everyone too beautiful? Yes and yes is the answer. But from having just zero presence on the international fashion stage just 20 years ago, London now sits alongside Milan and Paris as a kind of global fashion capital. And the UK produces and attracts some of the top creative talent in the industry. And people come to our country, they come to great cities and great universities like we have here in Manchester to exchange knowledge, show off their designs, and be part of that ecosystem of creativity and collaboration. That, in part, is due to our membership of the European Union and the market access that it gives us. And that's why top designers like Amanda Wakely and Alison Lanis, president of luxury clothing group Net-a-Porter, have spoken out in favour of remaining in the EU. Our fashion industry employs 600,000 people directly, and it's the third largest fashion sector in the EU after Italy and Germany. And most of those textile workers, whether they're working in Burberry in Castleford, Bynum in Wakefield, or John's Medley in Derbyshire, they're women. They are part of a sector that contributes £26 billion directly to the UK economy. And whilst I relish my own role in fighting for the UK to remain in the EU, I think it's more powerful to have women's voices from all backgrounds, trades and professions. We've had the TUC General Secretary, Frances O'Grady, EasyJet boss, Carolyn McCall, Tory peer, Karen Brady, television presenter, June Sarpong, and those fashion industry leaders. There is a sisterhood of women fighting to keep Britain in the EU. While they've made up their minds, many other women have still to decide. And polling shows us that up to a quarter of women are undecided about their vote on the 23rd of June, almost twice as many as a percentage terms as men. So what that means is that it could come down to women's votes to decide this referendum. And so much is at stake for women in this referendum. So taking my theme as the kitchen table, I started thinking about, you know, how we can bring this home to women in the UK. Why are women less likely to have made up their minds? Research on women's attitudes to the EU and the referendum by the pollster Deborah Mattinson highlights women's frustration at the nature of the discussion. They see and hear from too few women in the campaign. And haven't we just seen that over the last week? The biggest political decision of the last 40 years reduced to Tory party civil war. The Boris and Dave show, the jockeying around the future leadership of the Conservative Party. I find it boring and irrelevant. God knows what somebody whose job isn't politics finds it. The Tory party is split from top to bottom on the referendum, and they're banging on about Europe. So the Prime Minister, I think, has got to take great care that the whole debate does not become a giant turn-off for all voters, not just women. If it becomes a referendum about the Westminster political elite looking after its own political ambitions instead of looking after the ambitions of the country, and if that is going to be versus the grassroots alliance, the anti-politics uprising, the people in the funny ties, the risk for a Brexit grows higher. So Mattinson rightly argues the Remain camp needs to make our arguments more human-friendly, and as Andy said, rather than regurgitating statistics, that are far removed from everyday reality. So we need to focus on individual job security, and she's right on that, but I think we need to go much further. I think we need to make the case for our shared European values and our shared European culture. A culture which embraces and celebrates British fashion, British food, British football, just a few miles from Man United, I think there's a game going on today, British music, British films, and university research in a European context. This culture that allows young women and men to live, study, work abroad, and to fall in love with people from other countries and other cultures. And the risks to those vital sectors of our economy and our cultural life if we leave. Before you go, I want you to go upstairs. We're in the art gallery here, set up by the great fathers, it wasn't fathers of Manchester, who wanted the working classes to be able to have access to culture. There's an exhibition called To Be Human, and it's just one room, and it's got portraits of about 10 women. Some of the best paintings you'll see this year, I guarantee, from great European masters, Modigliani, Lucian Freud, Francis Bacon, Giacometti. I was very struck by the Giacometti picture of his mother's sister. It was a sketch done in 1939, and Giacometti, after the traumas of World War II, made all his figures thinner and thinner and thinner. And there's a theory that after the concentration camps, and having seen the results of the concentration camps, that's where some of Giacometti's sculptural, skeletal figures come from. But there's another portrait in there of a Jewish refugee who fled Austria in 1939 and settled in London with her family, but whose brother was killed by the Nazis. That's our shared European history. Those women's faces, those faces and portraits from the 20th century are here in Manchester as a reminder of our shared European context and a reminder of what it is to be human. This, as Andy says, cannot become a debate about British identity. So we know the benefits to women, working rights, equal pay for work of equal value, a fight long forgotten by a younger generation of feminists, but memorably documented in the film Maid and Dagenham. If you haven't been to see it, go today. The EU underpins maternity and paternity rights and the right to remain and to return to work after maternity leave. Women benefit from the right to sick leave and time off for urgent family reasons. And they're more likely to be in part-time, flexible or temporary work. And thanks to the EU, we now enjoy the same rights as full-time permanent employees. Women also benefit disproportionately from the EU's Erasmus Study Abroad programme. Of 270,000 Erasmus students, 60% were women. Perhaps I think that reflects their choices and their perhaps superior ability at learning languages, I do have to say that, as a French and Italian graduate. But it's also back to those values about the world we want to create and our solidarity as women with people struggling in developing countries, the drive to tackle all forms of violence against women, the drive to eradicate female genital mutilation. And the EU has worked very closely, as has our own government, with the government of Bangladesh to improve and change employment laws and factory inspections after the Rana Plaza disaster, where those women and men garment workers, 1,100 of them were killed in 2013 when that factory collapsed, making clothes for our British high street. So the Fashion Revolution charity, whose conference I'll be holding in Parliament in April, was formed by British women in response to that tragedy as we realised the true human cost of cheap clothes. British values are European values, and European values are British values. And women's rights are the building blocks of a civilised society, and the EU has underpinned those rights in the UK and exported them to developing countries for decades. If we leave, those hard-won rights will be put at risk and could reverse progress in eliminating the gender pay gap and take us back to the bad old days of discrimination against pregnant women and part-time workers and new mothers. So we mustn't make this the Boris hokey-cokey in, out for in, out for out. It can't be about that. This is the biggest decision that we will make in our lifetimes. We must fight for every vote and every woman's vote. While it can appear far removed, the EU has a very positive impact on the lives of British women. And if you think you're better off under the Tories in a Brexit, you only have to remember in 1997, the security industry in this country, £1 an hour, bring your own job. So I want to see more women at the front and centre of this campaign. It cannot be a referendum between the Eton rivals. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Marion. Over to you, Alex.
Thank you.
Gosh, I feel like lamb to the slaughter today, isn't it? One of me, I'm a visitor, and two politicians who have both given exit speeches. So I apologise, I'm not a politician, I've been in business all my life. I ran a toy business up in Blackpool, and then I bought Silver Cross, the pram company, which I looked after until about 6 months ago. I only talked until about 6 months. So why am I talking at all today, Saturday afternoon, spending a bit of time as a lamb to slaughter, coming to tell you my views on Brexit? Well, I am concerned. I have been concerned for some time. I got involved in Business for Britain. Why did I get involved in Business for Britain? Because I was involved in small business. There are SMEs all over this country. I think something like 65% of employees are work for SMEs. And I felt that we were not getting our voice heard. The voice was always heard by the CBI. The voice was always heard, the BBC was called them the voice of business, the establishment, in other words. And I felt that, along with two or three others, that the small business people, the SMEs, the people who are employing people all over this country, the growing businesses, for God's sake, not these large conglomerates, these large corporates, but companies that are growing. Because it's always the small businesses today, the Dyson, or the big businesses tomorrow. And that's why I felt our voice wasn't being heard. And what I was concerned about was this. I was concerned that the EU, as far as I could see as a businessman, was a big business club, an establishment club. And it seemed to me, in my case, in Silver Cross, for instance, we have all sorts of problems exporting to France. It's meant to be freedom of goods, trade. I can assure you there isn't freedom of trade in the EU. We had a lot of non-tariff barriers put up against us because the French were protecting themselves. And so that you people say, oh, we've got freedom of trade, freedom of movement, freedom of services. I know, I've been in business, I know it's not like that. It cost me about £20,000 to bring a whole load of crowns back from France. Those are the real issues that real businessmen were suffering. And I just felt that the CBI, if you talk to the likes of the president, Mike Martin Rave, you talk to BT, you talk to the BP and all the big companies, and it was just like it was with the euro, wasn't it? They all said, oh, we must join the euro. It would be a disaster economically if we didn't join the euro. And what happened? We didn't join the euro, and now I don't think there's one politician, maybe Andy would tell me I'm wrong, in this country who thinks we should join the euro. So these businesses, I felt, had to have a different argument. We as small business people, had to be represented. The fact of the matter is that you look now at Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, all the big city companies, all the big banks, City UK, they're all supporting exactly what my friends earlier were supporting. They're all supporting staying in. Why are they supporting staying in? Because it suits their businesses. I've got some numbers yesterday. HSBC last year spent 1.9 million euros lobbying in Brussels. They don't spend that for the benefit of themselves. They don't spend that, they don't reduce their profit because they know it works. They know that they can influence Brussels really well. BP last year, they spent 3.5 million euros on lobbyists influencing. This is what's going on, because it's like TTIP. You're probably all aware of TTIP. What's going on with TTIP now? Nobody knows, because it's quiet. We're not told what's going on. And I just feel that there's a lack of democracy. And for small businessmen like myself, I got involved because I thought this is not right, that we have to actually do something about this. So that's why I was involved and got involved in the debate. I thought I'd got a funny title, but I do feel that from a business point of view, we have to somehow bring back democracy to this country so that the large corporates, the large establishment, the civil service, all the main politicians, we are up against it, I fully accept that. But I feel that we should be bringing back the control. It's nothing to do with being a little Englander. In fact, I believe if we had Brexit, we would actually be looking out for the rest of the world. I think the EU is an analogue in a digital world, was a comment that Michael Gove made. But I think actually, it's true. We would actually be looking to go trade internationally. Because just for a second to talk about free trade. because free trade is very important. What free trade deals have the EU done recently? Well, I'll tell you.
Canada.
They finished one with Canada, and they have one with South Korea. Have they got one with China? Have they got one in India? They've been negotiating with India since 1996. But it's free trade that helps us all, that benefits us all. And then we hear about the arguments about jobs. Let's just mention for jobs for a second. 3 million jobs, I think, well, no, I was interviewed, 3.5 million jobs, I was told, are going to go from if we leave the EU. This is project scare, this is project fear. Because I don't believe that we'll stop trading with the EU. No one has ever said to me that if we're not in the EU, we'll stop trading with the EU. Of course we'll carry on trading with you. There isn't one country, with the exception, I think, of Belarus, in the whole of Europe, that doesn't have a free trade deal with the EU. So I don't see any reason why we shouldn't carry on trading. I want you to just look at some of the points that were mentioned about savings. I know for a fact that there's a document gone out by BSE saying, and it comes from a CBI survey, saying that the average family household will be £3,000 better off if we remain in the EU. And I looked at some work done by the Channel 4 News Fact Checker, and it's absolutely been proved that it is not true. So that's what we're up against. We're up against a lot of arguments, a lot of numbers, which in my opinion don't help the game at all. Business for Britain, we've done our work, we produced a document which is there called Change of Go, and we believe it would be a saving of about £930. But it's very, very marginal either way with regard to the finances. Immigration, a lot of talk about immigration. I certainly believe as a businessman that we need to control our borders. Not because I don't believe in immigration, because this country survives and has thrived on immigration, of course it does. But controlling our borders means that we can at least know the numbers coming in. Because when I do my business plans in 3 years, 5 years time, I need to know what my capital expenditure is going to be and how my business is going to run, what we're going to do to develop the business. The same for the government. They need to be able to, I would have thought anyway, to understand how many people are going to come in this country to look at, I'm talking about net migration now, to look at housing, to look at schools, hospitals, etc. So it strikes me that it's very, very obvious that controlling borders is a very, very sensible move for this country to take. And I don't believe if we stay in the EU, we can control those borders. Finally, I believe in taking control so that we can actually decide what we do with our money. I mean, I think something like 19 billion goes out gross every year to the EU. If we could spend that ourselves, in my opinion, that would be a much better way of dealing with that money. And, you know, people argue to me, well, actually 10 million comes back, but we don't decide where that 10 million comes back. A lot of it goes to the farmers and the Common Agricultural Policy. I think we should be in control of that money. We should have more, you know, I feel like we should have more confidence in ourselves. We're the fifth biggest economy in the world. We're a member of the UN Security Council. We are a really, truly great nation. We should have more confidence in ourselves. I believe that the EU is pulling us back. It is not a democratic system. The European Commission is not voted out. They're civil servants, as we all know. It's not voted by us. They make the laws. I mean, between 15 and 50% of the laws coming from the House of Commons Library are coming from the EU. What is it all about? Surely we should have enough confidence in ourselves to say we are in control. And then small businessmen like me, who feel totally up against the establishment, who feel that we have no say. A very quick word on, I did a debate with a chap called Roman Ruff, who runs PR company Brunswick, and I was pointing out to him the issues I had with the France and my crowns all coming back. And he said, well, just contact DG whatever in Europe. And I said, well, I don't even know where DG whatever is in Europe. I believe that my MP should be my contact. I believe that Westminster should be where these decisions are made. I believe that democracy should come back to the UK. And I believe if we get that, we're confident in our own ability, then I think Brexit could be pretty good for this country. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Alan. Thanks for that. We've had three really interesting, wide-ranging speeches on the need for a patriotic case, on the need for a women's case, and also the need to bring back control from the establishment. So over to you guys now. I've got a roving mic at the back, so can I see hand in the air for those who would like to ask questions? I'll take them in rounds of three. Okay, there's a woman there on my right-hand side, Caitlin, just in the middle of that row there with the necklace. sorry, in there, back a bit. That's it, yeah, with the stripy top, there we go.
And I have to say, first of all, I'm on the side of Andy and Mary, and they're debating the wider picture. But I do think that, Alan, you made really interesting points about the role of big business and the establishment. And as a Labour Party person, I want to look at that and think about it very carefully. What I'm not convinced of is how democracy and controlling global capitalism, if you want to call it for a better word, is going to be, and the TTC, how leading the EU is going to make that better. From my point of view, and it may be an ignorant one, my feeling is that actually we will be at the mercy of the worst excesses of global capitalism in its very worst, and I'm not anti-capitalist, but the very worst of it we will be at the mercy of if we leave the EU. And I'd like some comments on that from the panel.
Thank you. What's your name, sorry?
Sorry, Marcia.
Marcia, thank you very much. Okay. There's a hand in front and then a hand on the end of that row there, Caitlin, a second as well.
Thank you. It's Keith Mann. I think it's nearly 370 years since England became regarded as a basket case by the rest of Europe, the EU working on itself. And I do believe that we're in danger of doing that again. But the question I've got is, after years of austerity, stagnating and or reduced wages, exacerbated by inward migration and reductions in the social wage, why should the working person vote to remain or vote to leave?
Great, thank you very much. And then there's a hand there in the white shirt and the blue navy jumper.
Hi, my name is Stanley. This is a question for the whole panel. Really great speeches. I think Andy and Mary particularly focused on the issue of British identity. And I guess this question for the whole panel is, do you think it's possible to separate the issue of British identity, whether what it means to be British, from the argument of the EU debate? Because it seems to be, in prawn of everyone, it seems to muddy the issue and gets incredibly personal. Do you think it is possible to separate the issue? Would you think is definitely something we have to focus on in order to talk about the EU.
Okay, brilliant. Three fantastic questions there. I'll ask the panel to try and be brief with their responses, but Andy, we'll start with you.
Yeah. Marcia, yours is a really good question, because I went over to Alan and said something similar after he came and sat down, because there were, so I stand up, it's very easy. There were points he said that I agreed with about TTIP, and also because of the scale of the European Union, it can have a dialogue with the very biggest businesses, but it can't have a dialogue with the smaller businesses. So therefore, over time, it has become more a big business club. I agree with that. I think that's a very sound analysis. But my answer to Alan would be, don't cut your nose off to spite your face. Don't kind of throw it all out just because that's wrong with the European. Work to change that, but don't say that then we just completely leave. Because I think your point then was the crucial one, wasn't it? We've kind of had less of a focus in recent times on the social chapter, as it was once called. But you are absolutely right. If you break up, the multinationals have got a field day then, because they can just pick one country off against another. Oh, we'll invest here if you lower your national minimum wage. We'll invest here, but we'd like to see you get rid of that paid paternity and maternity leave. So companies then trade countries off one from another, and you have a race to the bottom on workers' conditions. And you have to make that case for a people's Europe and a social Europe. And this is where, to be honest, Europe has lost its way a little bit. It stopped doing that, and it's become more of a neoliberal TTIP, let's enshrine privatisation through trade agreements like TTIP, because it sounds like it's a big business club. And I agree with that analysis, but what I would say is, let's refocus it on that people's Europe, social Europe, but it's got to be better to protect people against, and this is the answer to the second question, it's got to be better to protect the individual workers if you say these standards apply across this wide economic area, this European Union, and these are flaws below which you as companies can't go. That has got to be in the individual workers' interest. And you mentioned inward migration. I believe there is an issue, actually, with the undercutting of wages. that Europe hasn't properly addressed. It is the case that people bring in workers who are skilled workers, plumbers, electricians, and pay them the minimum wage here, and then undermine the wages of the skilled workforce. But again, I would say the way to address it is not say, right, we're out of it, we're leaving. Have rules within the European Union to protect skilled wages so that, you know, Europe doesn't become a kind of a big business club again whereby people can move labour around for their interests and undermine the wages of people. So I would always say stay in but improve it. Don't just throw it all. I was going to say don't throw your toys out of the pram, but that's going to be the wrong thing to say to Alan, definitely. Stanley, on your point, I thought very carefully about this when I came to before I made the argument that I made. Generally, I don't think it can. Because in effect, remain, leave. The question is inviting you to say, what do you want Britain to be? What is Britain? What role do you want it to play? Who do you think we are? What kind of country are we? It's inviting us to answer that question on what it is to be British in the 21st century. What do you want your country to be in the 21st century? And my worry is, and this is why I made the argument that I made in my speech, don't give the other side the kind of hold over that side of things, as though they're the only ones wrapped up in red, white and blue. Britishness is about being outward looking. It is about playing our part in the wider world, as we did in the last century, to secure peace in Europe. That is who we are and what we have been. And let's grab that ground back from them and let those who want to stay in the European Union. So my great-grandfather who died in the First World War, I think he was fighting for peace in Europe. That's what he probably thought he was doing. And the people who lost their lives in the Second World War, that was definitely what they were doing. So why are we as a country now saying, actually we want to go back to a Europe that is fragmented? Well, I don't think that is in keeping with the sacrifices this country made in the last century. And that is why I say, yes, it is about British identity, and let's redefine what it is to be British from a side that says we're progressive, we're staying in. Definitely make the economic case, but my argument to you today is let's from the left of politics, make the patriotic case as well.
Thank you. Mary, over to you. Well, I'd like to start with Stanley. So I think we do need to make the case about British identity, but British identity has always been about a confident, outward-looking trading nation that welcomes and exchanges with people of other nations. And that's because we're an island nation. We had no other choice. You know, I'm reading a History of the World in 100 Objects, and for people in 5th century East Anglia, they were closer to the Vikings in Scandinavia and the Netherlands than they were to people in what's now Wiltshire, because there were no roads. So, you know, we've had thousands of years of getting on our ships and rowing off into the yonder, not too sure about where we're going to land. But, you know, people have courage and they have optimism and they think they're going to find something better on the other side of the sea. And I think we've got to talk about that. That's who we are. And this issue about identity, I remember going on my first visit to Crete. And there was this great old boy that had a hotel and a farm, and I met him, and I said, oh, he had blue eyes, and he was you know, he spoke very little English, and I said, oh, I'm British. He said, we love the British. And I said, oh, great, you know, excellent. I said, me, my father, my mother, my brother, and the British, all against the Germans. It was all those great moments. It's like, oh, I didn't know history. So for me, it was like, oh, was Greece on our side? You know, and of course, they, you know, so this resistance, our common cause with the Greek people from 1940. You go to Crete on your holidays, there's some old boy there remembering what it was like to be a lad when the Nazis and the fascists were in town. Well, not really in town, it's like, you know, in the mountains. Keith, why should working people vote to remain? Why should working people vote to leave? Well, the sort of corollary to that question is, why should working people vote at all? Working people should vote because they struggle for the vote. Working women should vote because they struggle for the vote. And we should vote in the interests of what we think is best for our family, our city, our country, but also our continent and the world. And I don't know about 307, like I said, 300, I didn't do history, but you're right, people haven't had a pay rise. In Wakefield, we've had the third lowest wage growth in the country over the last 8 years. And so you're right to raise the question, you know, I've not seen much
We could argue that that's got more to do with the austerity economics of George Osborne and the global financial headwinds, which are now coming back in. He's warning again, you know, softening up the ground before another very difficult budget, the collapse in banking shares, in the Chinese economy, the US downturn. All of these things affect our country. The only question is, are we better off trading tariff-free to a market of 500 million people, even without the French protectionism, and they are very good at protectionism, the French. Historically, you know, the very first French case was the Germans trying to import something to France, and then the French guys going, oh, I don't think so. We'll you need a certificate for that. And that was the very first case that allowed free trade between France and Germany in the 60s, I think it was. And Marcia, your point on big business. Yeah, look, George Osborne didn't go to Brussels to lobby on behalf of saving British steel jobs and against Chinese dumping. He went to Brussels to lobby for the bankers' bonus cap to be removed that we'd left when we were in government. I mean, you know, we know whose side the Tories are on. And if you think, Alan, that the HSBC and Goldman Sachs has spent a lot of money lobbying the EU over the last year, 2 years, whatever, I can tell you that's peanuts compared to the amount of money that they've spent lobbying and funding the Conservative Party. And some of those super rich individuals are the ones that turn up at the black and white ball year after year after year. So if we think that, you know, I mean, the issue around Canada is a big trading nation. And some of the wrinkles in that trade agreement were around agricultural and food products. But I'm all for cheaper maple syrup, by the way. So I'm glad about the Canada deal. But if you think, I mean, I want to say a quick thing about TTIP. TTIP has the potential to cover 40% of the world's GDP. If that deal ever gets negotiated, and let's face it, other successive rounds of global trade, the Doha round took 13 years and then collapsed. If that deal goes through, I want to be part of it for our country's sake. I do not want our National Health Service to be part of it. And I don't want some stupid investor-state disputes mechanism coming in and having a row so that we end up with big American companies suing the British government because they didn't make as much money as they thought. That's the point of capitalism. You take a risk, as Alan did, buying Silvercross, selling his business, buying another one, building it up, selling it again. You take risk-taking. It's not about a capitalist club where you come in and your risk is underwritten by the taxpayer, as has too often been the case with the banking industry and the financial services industry. So let's have a bit more risk, but it's not the risk of the paying conditions of workers in this country, and it's not the risk of our NHS being carved up like a Christmas turkey.
Okay, I'm probably not going to answer the questions very well because I getting them in the right order. But I found quite difficult. Just want to say a couple of things. First of all, on freedom of movement, I know that there's been some in the negotiation. There's been some deal on benefits or whatever. But I don't believe that. I think that will be challenged anyway in the European Court of Justice. Because at the end of the day, we're all European citizens. And European citizens can go where they want to, and they can't discriminate. So I don't quite know how Andy's going to be able to discriminate with regard to wages and skill sets or whatever. I'm not sure how that will happen. Maybe I'm, as I say, that's as I understand the situation. The working man, well, when you say the working man, I'm assuming you mean well, anyone who has a job, because we're all working.
And women.
the working person, I beg your pardon. Surely the working person should vote to leave. Because at the end of the day, the position for this country can be that we can be confident that we can actually go out and sign. People talk about TTIP. I mean, there are the investor dispute protection is, I think, will be a disaster. It's already been proved. You know, tobacco companies are already suing in Australia against the government. It is a complete disaster. But this is what the EU is giving us. And it's about time which people stood up and said, we don't want it. You know, why can't we do our own trade deals as a country? Why can't we have enough confidence with our politicians here and here, with our civil service, to do the UK's trade deals? Australia's just done a trade deal with Japan. Switzerland's done one with China. Surely it's up to us to get off our backsides
you know, as a businessman, I want to say I traded in China for many, many years. I know I would love a free trade deal with China. These are the sort of things that help business, that help trade. So from the working man's point of view, it is about time that we...
Can I challenge you?
Just to go on quickly.
Surely, though, it would be we'd get a better deal when you go into the negotiating room as equals, the European Union and China. You won't get a very good deal going in as a smaller player, taking on the Chinese or the Russians.
I totally disagree with that point.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. And I'll tell you why I disagree with it. The problem is 28 countries in the EU, they've all got their own priorities. With the priorities Italian wine, priorities German cars, I don't know what it is, but British wine. They have got their priorities. And that's why, if it was so easy to work, why did Peter Mandelson start doing an Indian free trade deal in about 1996, and we still haven't got it? Where's our free trade? The EU started in 1953. Where are the free trade deals now? Why haven't we got them? We haven't got them because they can't work together. Britain could work together, we could do it ourselves, and I think that we as a country should have enough confidence, because big is not always better. And I honestly can't remember the other question, so I do apologise.
Right, we've got time for a quick final round, so let me see hands. I'll go over to this side. So hand at the front, down here, Caitlin, and then hand over there, and then hand in the front row there. And then I'm afraid that's all the questions we can take.
Yep. I'm Martin Willey. It's been a very familiar sort of debate so far this afternoon. I think immigration is going to be the biggest factor in this discussion. And I've come off a street stall, a Labour Inn street stall in Buckland this morning, and immigration was an issue there. There are issues of prejudice there, but I think a lot of the people who are going to vote in this referendum would be concerned that immigration creates problems for them in competition for housing, for jobs. They're concerned about welfare, and they're also concerned about the cultural changes it makes to where they live. And so I think we've got a real problem, those of us that want to stay within the EU, to convince those people that the immigration has benefits for this country, and that there are steps that we can take over housing impact funding for areas that are most influenced by immigration, because otherwise I think the vote will go against us. And I think the danger is that certainly David Cameron's approach and a lot of the other approaches are that it's part of the package, put up with it. And I don't think we need to be much more positive about it. I think if we don't get the immigration arguments right, that we will lose the fight. So what can we do to resolve that?
Thank you. And there was a hand over there, Caitlin, one there, the blue shirt.
For many years I've actually been quite Eurosceptic, and until today you've actually persuaded me, the two of you people. So my issue is, however, that you've mentioned the thinking a couple of times that you feel that you can only change things by being in Europe, and there are issues of democracy. Things are undemocratic and Europe isn't a utopia. It's not perfect. I just wanted to know how you would possibly redress some of those things, but also anybody that would sort of maybe think about getting out, think about a society where it's actually at the mercy of the present Tory government, I think would be excruciating, because it's actually quite bad anyway at the moment. That actually being in Europe is actually creating at least fair conditions which are there to help rather than hinder Britain. That's the reason why you've actually persuaded me today rather than go through the Eurosceptic vote. But I just wanted to know how you would possibly make it more democratic.
And your name, sorry?
It's Catherine.
Thank you very much. And just hand the mic in front of you, just there, in the front row.
Oh, sorry, mate.
Sorry, that's right. Cheers, Caitlin.
Hi, I'm Seth. I'm actually a businessman from the area. And basically, very, very simply, in terms of immigration, there's a reason, obviously, why people want to come to Britain, etc. Successive governments have had opportunities to address this. and none of them seem to have addressed it, hence why the public have got so many negative perceptions of it. That's the first point. The second point was, but Alan, your points were brilliant. It makes a change not to have this UKIP rubbish, with regards to leaving the EU, and some of the points you made were absolutely brilliant. And regarding lobbying, regardless of the amount of what they're paying in the EU, etc., as Mary said, they do the same thing here. What we actually really need to do is curb the amount of lobbying these companies are allowed to do in Brussels and in Westminster. That's probably the better question, because it's just going to happen in Westminster. They use their funds, they won't go to Brussels, they just go straight to London. That's what's going to happen.
Great, thank you. I'll go in reverse order this time, and I can ask the panel to be brief. We've only got 5 minutes to get through.
I might be able to remember all three. Very quickly, on the lobbying front, my view is that the issue with the lobbying, why it's much more dangerous for us in the EU, is because the EU is not a democracy. And you have got closed doors. You have no Freedom of Information Act like we have in Westminster. So the TTIP discussions are going on. Nobody has a clue what is being talked about. I can assure you, you get a few things from Greenpeace, but you don't get much at all. There is not the visibility that we would have in Westminster with the freedom of information and also the press that we have here. Mm-hmm. I couldn't remember. I can't remember. I'm sorry.
If you want me to come back, Martin, you come back when you've heard us, because it might prompt your memory. This debate cannot be about immigration. I know that is what the Tories want it to be about, the Leavers want it to be about, and UKIP want it to be about. But we as the Labour Party will never out UKIP. Now, you're right about Cameron's renegotiation. Some of the things that he's got were in our own manifesto, so the right to in-work benefits you put in before you can take out. But we mustn't allow the Conservatives' failure to plan adequately on housing, on school places, on the National Health Service, to be used as a proxy to beat people who come to this country to work and seek a better life for themselves and their families. And on the immigration statistics, the government has set itself up, and it's set itself up to fail. Because in opposition, they said they could get net immigration down to the tens of thousands, and successive figures have shown it's coming down slightly, but 323,000 is, I'm not very good at maths, but that's more than the net tens of thousands. So half of those immigrants are coming in from outside the European Union. They're not coming in from Eastern European states. They're coming in from outside through a visa system, and it's a points-based system that we introduced when we were in government. Now, we didn't talk a lot about that when we were in government, and part of that was because the economy was growing, in some cases at more than 3% a year, so we needed people to come here in times of low unemployment and high growth to do and to be part of our economy. The two things that are contributing to growth in the UK economy at the moment are immigration and people borrowing against the rising value of their houses. Mm. So if we think these are stable, this is we've got to be clear about where growth is coming from, and immigration is an important part of growth. But that means, sadly, that productivity is declining because more people are doing the same sort of job, but just generally for less money. So that's the problem. It's the wage depression that I think is really bad. And we have to tackle the human traffickers, the criminal gangs, the people that put people in 10 people to a three-bedroom house, have them working on shifts, taking their money, taking their passports and exploiting them. And we know that that is going on. And we know that people are living in disused office buildings with dangerous gas boilers that are in danger of killing them from carbon monoxide and all of those things. So the government's got to do more to crack down on rogue landlords, crack down on rogue employers. And we've got to take the debate out of immigration, because we've got to feel confident about talking about these things. But if it's just about that, we will lose. Catherine, I'm delighted that you changed your mind. You talked about the democratic debt. Yeah. Democratic deficit. Look, our MPs have been in Europe for many years, and they've done things like reforming the common agricultural policy, taking it down from 2/3 of the EU budget down to about 45% now. We've done all sorts of that, and they're part of the blockage in the TTIP negotiations. Our MEPs, Labour MEPs, I don't think it's Tory and UKIP MEPs, are helping to stop the TTIP
including the NHS. So there is democratic oversight, and not a single decision takes place at EU level without a member of our government agreeing to it. So all this stuff about the deficit, the Council of Ministers sits down, nods it through. It's a bit like learning to play nicely when you're at nursery. You know, sometimes you get the toy, sometimes somebody else gets the toy, and it's about that sort of give and take, isn't it, that we teach our children from a very young age. Sam, you talked about the lobbying register. I mean, we need a lobbying register in this country, but what have the Tories done? They've put the frighteners on the charitable sector. So instead of having a register of lobbyists for big business, so we have transparency about how much, I don't know how much HSBC has spent lobbying the UK government. I know how much they spent in the EU, because Alan's just told me. But, you know, I'd be very curious to know that. And we've got charities now that are told that they can't interfere in political issues. They should go away and mind their own business. That's the sort of lobbying the government doesn't want. They don't want lobbying against child poverty. They don't want lobbying against slum landlord conditions. They don't want lobbying against low wages and a reduction in pay and conditions at work. I wonder why that is.
So Martin, I think you're right, and I mean I take a maybe slightly different view from Mary on this about saying deal with it and move on, because I think you have to really face it, confront it in a way that probably the left hasn't done in 20 years, and this is the moment to do it, isn't it? And to on the one hand make the positive case for free movement, because there is a very strong positive case, but also deal with the practical effects. And there are practical effects that arise from free movement. And the way I would look at it is this. Politicians come on the TV sometimes, people like us, and they'll say, you know, either in a kind of black or white thing, immigration's a good thing, or immigration's a bad thing. It's like people will take one view or the other. The truth is, immigration has a differential impact on different parts of the country. So if you take a former industrial area like the one I represent, or a coastal area, there is evidence that it's undercut wages. And also, there is evidence that those places have seen the most rapid social change through free movement, particularly since the accession countries came in. And I think part of the problem on this issue is Westminster and Brussels haven't recognised those issues that those communities are facing. So consequently, they feel neglected, as though no one's listening. And then they want to protest at Europe. And I understand that, because I hear it, I see it in my own constituency. So my answer to them is not to say, we just then, right, we pull out, we pull up the drawbridge. My answer is to say, let's deal with the practical effects. And I made this argument in my own leadership campaign, and I'm carrying on making it as Shadow Home Secretary. But like Alan, I believe we can protect wages through the European Union. There was a proposal in 2008 to protect skilled wages so that in European law, industry-approved agreements would be respected and couldn't be undercut by agencies, abusing free movement rules to undercut skilled wages. And that wasn't implemented, partly because the CBI objected to it. But that, I think, is an issue, because Europe can sometimes work better for companies than it works for people. If you're in an area like mine where shifts are brought in to undercut the local workforce. So let's argue for a change of that kind. Another change I think we should have is that Europe should give more money to areas that see most rapid change. So there is extra pressure at the GP surgery. There is extra pressure on the primary schools as a result of rapid change. And that often is in the most poorest parts of the country where that happens. And yet they get not a single penny extra from government or from Brussels to help deal with those pressures. Well, they should get extra money to deal with those pressures, to employ Polish classroom assistant or whatever it might be. And that, I think, is, you need a practical answers to these issues. However, you then also need to make a bigger case and deal with the myths. It is a fact that people who come here from the European Union are much more likely to be net contributors to the public purse than net takers. Now, I know that isn't what the newspapers say, but those are the facts, because they tend to be younger, they tend not to have dependents, they tend to be at a stage of their career when they are on those early stages, going up in their late 20s, early 30s. And overall, EU migration, according to the studies that the LSE and others have done, shows that they EU migrants are net contributors to UK finances rather than net takers. Now, you have to take this argument on and make that argument and explain that to the public, as well as dealing with some of the negatives that arise, and don't deny the fact that some issues do arise that need practical solutions. So that's what I would argue for. Take it head on and deal with it, but then make the argument too that it's a two-way street, that there are thousands of people from the northwest of England left here to work abroad in our past, and there are many more working abroad today. It is a two-way street. Just a couple of quick points in conclusion on the other issues that were raised. I'm too really pleased that you've been persuaded. Of course, it's not perfect, and to be honest, Alan is right about the secrecy around TTIP. It's not defensible. I wouldn't seek to defend it. You can't have institutions operating in that way. But it comes back to that point. Stay in to change it. Don't say, right, we're out, we're ripping it all up, and we're taking our ball home. Don't do that. Stay in Europe to change Europe and make it more democratic, make it more transparent, make it more accountable. But you know, you made the point about Tory governments of the past, you know, workers being more at risk. Well, let's remember that. They didn't sign up to the social chapter in the early days, remember? Mm-hmm. So people were being paid
£1 an hour.
Absolutely appalling wages. They weren't protected at work. And then when we signed up to the social chapter, people got better protection in the workplace. And those are protections now that are there for people as members of the European Union. And then on the last question, you made the point about the negative diet, really. And that's what we're up against, isn't it? And it's going to get worse and worse, isn't it, over the coming weeks, about the kind of negative stories. And that's why I think this referendum, if it is to be won by the Remain side, it needs to be won on the doorstep. It needs to be won by people in the workplace, in their street, talking to their neighbours. And in many ways, we could all of us this afternoon go through all the micro arguments as to why you should stay in. But I come back to where I started. Look at Britain in the 20th century. Think about the first half of the 20th century when there was no European Union. Think about Europe then. Think about the conflict in Europe. Think about the lives lost. And then think about Europe in the second half of the 20th century with those European institutions as they began to bind people together, as they began to make us work together as a group of people. Now, surely if you look at that, the EU has succeeded in its own terms in bringing peace, prosperity, stability to all of the countries of Europe. It has succeeded, notwithstanding all of its flaws and the things that make us irritated about it. In that big picture argument, it has succeeded. Why do we now deny all of that and walk away from it? Stay in to change it and make it even better. But you know, let's stay in, make the argument to stay in, because it's true to Britain's past and everything we fought for as a country.
Okay,
in response to Andy, stay in and change from within. How many times have we heard that? Time and time again. We can change things from within. We're not changing things. We try and change things in the European Council, the European Commission. We're not changing things. Why do we have the confidence to come out and say, let's do it ourselves? With regard to security, I just want to say one thing. NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organisation, has kept the security, in my opinion, rather than Europe. Europe has made two first-class errors in foreign policy, in Bosnia and Ukraine. I could go on a lot and on about that, but I believe that security of this country has not come from the EU, it has come from our involvement with NATO.
Brilliant. Thank you so much to the panel. Give them a round of applause. It's been a fantastic time. So my colleagues can come to the front. So stay seated. There's going to be a video from Julie Ward, MEP, and then they'll have a new panel up on the stage for us.
I feel a bit like